You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, good morning, and thank you for coming. I'm Cam Carey. I'm the Ann R. and Andrew H. Distinguished Visiting Fellow here at the Brookings Institution. I want to welcome you to our conversation with Sophie Hinfeldt of the European Parliament. I remind you to please silence cell phones, but feel free to use them to live tweet this event with the hashtag up on the screen. So Sophie Hinfeldt has been since 2004 a member of the European Parliament from the Netherlands, a member of the ALDE group, the group of liberals and Democrats in the European Parliament. And in particular, for most of that time, she's been a member of the Libe Committee, the Justice and Civil Liberties Committee of the European Parliament, or the equivalent, I guess, of our Judiciary Committee. Is that who you regard as your counterpart, mostly?
Civil Liberties, Justice, and Home Affairs. So
right.
It's very broad.
In that capacity, has been outspoken about civil liberties issues, particularly about surveillance. She was certainly in the forefront of critics of U.S. surveillance, both before and after the Snowden revelations. But not just on surveillance issues, LGBT rights and immigrant rights and others. So I expect we're going to have a pretty outspoken conversation. So Sophie Hinfeldt, welcome.
Thank you.
You come at a pretty extraordinary time in transatlantic relations after all of the events last week in Brussels, in the UK, in Helsinki. So talk a little bit about that. And, you know, you're here with the Libe Committee and with other members of Parliament as part of the transatlantic policy network, a series of discussions, meetings with the government and counterparts on the Hill. What are you talking about? What are the issues? What are you saying to people about events and of affairs?
I think the particular group that I am part of this week, because there are many groups from the European mm-hmm. Parliament visiting, but this particular delegation has been discussing data protection and security issues mainly, a bit of immigration and visa liberalization as well. But clearly very high on the agenda, usually the first topic that people address are indeed the transatlantic relations. And in particular, in light of the, unusual statements of President Trump in the last week, well, also before, but in particular in the last week when he was in Europe. And I think his statements have, of course, caused a lot of unease and indignation also in the United States. And a lot of, I would say, it left the Europeans more perplexed than anything else. We're not quite sure how to respond to this. But I think one thing is clear, and that is the transatlantic relations are very, they're very good, they're very solid, resilient. But I think... we're also looking at a bit of a reset, and that has to do with changing geopolitics, but it also has to do with changes inside the European Union, the evolution, the further integration of the European Union. And I think, in a way, it is... I think it's healthy for the European Union to be a little bit more on its own, and we have to take a bit more responsibility for ourselves and for our position in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you've been sort of an equal opportunity critic of government surveillance, and by that I mean that you've been critical, as I mentioned, of U.S. surveillance, but also of surveillance by European governments.
Oh, yes.
I think you sued the United States, but you're now in a lawsuit with the French government.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? what that's about?
Yes, where
that is?
Well, I just got a ruling a couple of weeks ago, which was negative, which was not totally unexpected. So we're now going to take it to a higher level, to the human rights courts in Strasbourg, because we're not, let's say, opposed in principle to surveillance, but it has to be proportionate and necessary, as we say, in the European Union. And I think the French surveillance law is disproportionate. And what's even more interesting is that the law goes back to 2015, but it was discovered that in the period from 2008 to 2015, the French government, or rather the secret services, were carrying out blanket surveillance without any legal base. So I've challenged that as well, and saying, because I, as a member of the European Parliament, we meet in France, in Strasbourg, once a month. So, you know, I could theoretically also be in their records somewhere, and I want to know. So that's one of the reasons I went to court. But interestingly, they had a very intricate legal reasoning why they could say nothing about that past period, saying, because that's the past. Yes, but all the data that were collected during those 7 years are still stored somewhere, and they can still be used. So, but this is it's an interesting case, and I kind of enjoy using all the instruments that democracy offers to us to find the right balance between government powers and individual freedoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to a discussion that we were having yesterday about those individual freedoms and the role of privacy in those freedoms. People sometimes see the United States as sort of Venus and the United States and Europe as kind of Venus and Mars when it comes to privacy issues. Do you think there are fundamental differences in the way that Europeans and Americans conceive of privacy? What do you think is sort of the underlying conception?
Fundamental differences, I don't think. And it's true that often people in Europe think that there is no privacy protection at all in the US, which is not true. There's quite an extensive legal toolkit, if you want, of protections. But it has a different starting point for European citizens. Privacy protection and data protection, which are two different things, but they are fundamental rights. They're on a par with, the right to life, ban on slavery, and all the other fundamental rights that we have, freedom of speech, equal treatment, and all the rest of it. It is a legal right. It's legally enforceable. And it's not something, I mean, you have to, of course, accommodate it in certain ways, but it's not, as people sometimes think, a right that you can... There can be no trade-off with other purposes, like economic purposes or even security. Or they have to be accommodated. And so I think that is different. And maybe it also has something to do with the history of the European continent. I think we have some bad experiences with governments knowing everything about citizens, in particular in the former communist dictatorships. And I often sense that in particular my older colleagues from the Central and Eastern European countries who had first-hand experience of what that means, they tend to be a little bit diffident about surveillance systems, and because they don't immediately get the feeling that, you know, they're safer because of it, because they have bad memories. Mm-hmm. So I think that all plays a role. But in essence, I think the desire that we all have, we Europeans and I'm sure Americans as well, to be protected against too much intrusion, whether it's by governments or companies, abuse of our data, data that are not adequately protected. I don't think that there's a fundamental difference there between Americans and Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that brings us to the privacy shield. That's a major topic, certainly, this week of your discussions as U.S. and the EU go into the second annual review process of the privacy shield. European Parliament, I think you were a leader in this, voted to call on the Commission to suspend the Privacy Shield agreement. That's something that took place on July 4th. I'm not sure that was entirely accidental, because I also recall that in 2013, when I was still in the government, in the wake of the Snowden affair, the European Parliament voted to condemn U.S. surveillance and called on the Commission to suspend the safe harbor agreement that preceded Privacy Shield, also on July 4th.
So I think
is there a deliberate irony in the scheduling of those votes?
No, I don't think we picked the date deliberately, but I noticed that when people realized what date it was, that they thought it was funny. But the thing is, Safe Harbor was cancelled by the courts after repeated calls from the European Parliament to the European Commission to do this. Because for years we had been very critical. There had been two evaluation reports there was an external evaluation that was very critical of Safe Harbor itself and the implementation. Those critical reports were somehow, I don't know, put in a drawer by the European Commission. They disappeared. They weren't visible on the internet anymore. And the Commission just stubbornly refused to repeal Safe Harbor and replace it with something better. So then the European Court of Justice annulled, basically, Safe Harbor. Then there was a kind of a grace period for companies where the Data Protection mm-hmm. Authority said, okay, we're not going to enforce because that's not reasonable, because it's not, you know, the companies are not to blame. And then they put in place a Privacy Shield. Now, it has been challenged, like Safe Harbor, it has been challenged in court. I don't know exactly when the court will rule, and I don't know how it will rule, but we have very, very strong concerns about the substance of Privacy Shield. We feel that it is still not legally sound. And the second issue is, of course, even if it's, you know, whether it's legally sound or not, is the implementation. And there we feel that the implementation is not adequate, which I think is a shame, because it's been in place for, a year and a half now, I believe, almost 2 years. I mean, ample time to fulfill all the criteria, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about the implementation that you think is not adequate?
Well, you know, there's the issue of oversight, for example. There's the ombudsman, which has still not been. There's no definitive ombudsman which has been appointed. Now they tell us, okay, this is an acting ombudsman, which is just as good. Okay, but then I don't understand why in 2 years' time you can't appoint somebody, you know. Make a final appointment. The PCLOB, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which has not been, which has not had its quorum for the whole last period. Now, three persons have been nominated, three Republican candidates, I believe, and there's one Democrat. Yeah, and then there's still a vacancy, so they cannot operate. So it's that kind of thing. So it's not even something very complicated, and it's just very difficult to understand why even the simplest terms of the agreement mm-hmm. cannot be applied. And then, of course, there's the issue of what's called Section 702, which was basically extended for another 6 years. It was even widened a little bit, and that was one of the points of concern. So, you know, we thought, why was that necessary, and why wasn't it possible to, for example, include what is now the Presidential Policy Directive number 28, which for us, Presidential Policy Directive sounds like something really funny. Like, it's not a proper law. It can be repealed, you know, on arbitrary grounds at any given moment. Now, the administration told us, yes, yes, but that's all theoretical because it's being applied. You know, it's been so ingrained in the system now. It cannot be repealed. But quite frankly, if I look at the current president, I don't know. I somehow don't feel entirely reassured. I mean, you know, call me paranoid, but I just don't feel that that is sufficient. And I also don't understand why, if it's already so solid, then why can it not simply be transferred into or transposed into a law? So it all gives us the impression that the political will is actually not there to really fully grant all the safeguards. And then again, there is of course still the issue that we feel it is not 100% compliant with the court ruling on safe harbor.
Mm-hmm. So what responses have you gotten from the U.S. government on these issues this week?
Well, in summary, that we shouldn't worry, that everything is fine. And in fairness, without being cynical, they are making an effort to implement, you know, large parts of the Privacy Shield terms. But there are still these points of concern which have not been met. So it's not that they're not doing anything at all. That's not what I'm saying. But we are still critical of a number of points that have to be addressed, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things that's changed since the last annual review is that the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, has taken effect. And it seems to me that for most of the companies that are transferring data to the U.S. Under the Privacy Shield, that they are subject to the GDPR. So that being the case, what difference do the protections of the Privacy Shield make now that GDPR is in place?
Well, I think they will make a difference because GDPR is essentially about what they do in Europe. This is about data being transferred outside Europe, and they may also be used by the authorities, for example.
Why did they stop being subject to the GDPR if the data is transferred out of Europe?
Well, it all depends on the purpose. And this is part of GDPR. This is about, mm-hmm. because Privacy Shield is essentially an adequacy finding, as we call it, saying, okay, data being transferred to another country, which does not have a GDPR, but it should have something which is an adequate level of data protection, or, as the court said, it has to be essentially equivalent to the European system. So that is part of the, let's say, the mm-hmm. GDPR logic, but it's no longer literally under GDPR. Now, I have, you know, this, again, the adequacy finding is an instrument foreseen in the GDPR, so we support that. We just feel that the adequacy decision that was taken by the European Commission is unjustified. That's the only point. And also, this is about data being transferred, which can then also be used by the authorities, which is, of course, another area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think my point is, under GDPR, you need Privacy Shield as a legal basis to transfer the data to the United States still. But in terms of the level of protection that the companies provide to that data when it's in the United States, now GDPR travels with the data.
To a large extent,
yeah.
Yes. But I don't think that is not the part that we are that we're worried about. And this is also where, for example, the FTC is overseeing compliance by the companies if they're living up to that part. But that actually also brings me to another point of concern about implementation or application. Facebook and Cambridge Analytica used Privacy Shield and its predecessor Safe Harbor to transfer data to the United States to be used for the purposes that we now know. And then I think, you know, Safe Harbor existed before. It was faulty, yes, but it was there. We now have Privacy Shield. I believe it's faulty, but it's there. Then it should be applied. How is it possible that, you know, already back in 2016, the media reported about what Cambridge Analytica and Facebook were doing, and maybe they didn't know every detail yet, but why is it that then the authorities didn't respond? Why was there no investigation? Why? I mean, they're investigating now, but it could have been done much earlier. Mm-hmm. So that also gives us a feeling. So, you know, how thorough are they? How what does this bring in practice?
Mm-hmm. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about another issue on which you've been critical of U.S. law. That's the Cloud Act, the legislation designed to allow extraterritorial access to data under our Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This was coming out of the Microsoft case and Microsoft warrant in Ireland. You've been critical of that. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, to be perfectly clear, and this applies to a lot of different files, yes, I'm very often critical of U.S. policies, but I'm 10 times more critical of the way that the European Commission is protecting and applying European laws, just to be clear. But why am I critical? Because, I mean, this means, from my perspective as a European citizen, that the authorities of a third country that I am not a citizen of and where I do not have any, let's say, established rights and where I have no voting rights, that third country can get access to my data. And I have very, hardly any means of legal redress. Now, and people, I mean, it's all also about psychology, because people think, oh, you know, stop, this is the United States, it's a civilized country, they're our best friends and allies, you know, you can trust them. But if you use a different example, say Russia were to do the same. Say Russia adopts a Russian Cloud Act that allows it through the Google office in Moscow. I'm pretty sure Google has an office in Moscow as well. And they go to Google in Moscow and say, bring us all the data that you've stored in the U.S. I don't think the American government would like that. You know. And the same goes for China. China is a big country. And even if initially, I'm sure that if they were to adopt such a law, then the Americans and Europeans would say, well, hang on a bit, you know, there's a limit, you can't do this. But they're a huge, they're an economic superpower by now. They've got a lot of economic weight to throw about. So, you know, I don't feel comfortable with this. And I also don't think, first of all, it's not necessary because we have instruments. Secondly, if you adopt such a law, then I think it should be done in a proper democratic procedure. That was not the case here. It was adopted on the back of what's called an omnibus package or something else in any case. And then you do it also, I mean, if we are friends and allies, I don't really see why this cannot be done, you know, in a joint process, why we cannot talk about these things together. And I also think if you adopt this kind of legislation, any kind of legislation giving more powers to the law enforcement and security authorities, then at the same time you also have to strengthen citizens' rights. What I see is that a lot of a lot of legislation has been passed over the last, let's say, 15, 20 years, which first of all gives more powers to the authorities, and secondly gives legal backing, legal protection to companies. And I don't disagree with those two things. But citizens are increasingly left out in the cold on their own. They're up against the authorities that have massive powers. You know, I have to say, one of the things, I'm very critical of the US often, but one of the things where I really, really envy you is your FOIA system. That is really something that we should have in Europe. I mean, we have something similar, but it's incredibly weak and cumbersome. It's not really. I've litigated on that as well a couple of times. But so, you know, that is, for example, we should have, if you have more powers for authorities, then you also need a stronger FOIA. You need stronger legal safeguards. It's a matter of balance, because in my view, call me naive or primitive or something, but in my view, the state still works for the citizens and not the other way around. And citizens should be able to control the state, the authorities, and not the other way around. And yes, we give powers to the authorities, for example, to keep us safe. But in a democracy, the essence of democracy is that powers are never unlimited and unchecked. And that is increasingly happening. So it's all a matter, it's not a matter of saying yes or no, for example, to surveillance powers or something like the US Cloud Act. It's all a matter of proportionality and giving proper protections, really enabling citizens to defend themselves against abuse of power or excess of power or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. So, but why doesn't the Cloud Act provide the opportunity for that sort of joint discussion about legal standards that you talked about? I mean, it provides for international agreements, for reciprocal rights, says that those international agreements must have basic rule of law protections, and that you know, transnational evidence requests need to be based on reasonable justification, articulable and credible facts, particularity, legality, you know, a lot of the standards that I think are analogous to necessity and proportionality. And subject to oversight by a court judge or other independent authority. Isn't that helping to raise the bar on legal standards?
I'm not saying.
And isn't the e-evidence proposal on the EU side having the same effect? So isn't that a basis on which to have that conversation across the Atlantic?
I think it's good that you call it the e-evidence proposal, because that's what it is, a proposal, and Parliament still has to debate it and process it and adopt a position. Then we have to negotiate with the Council, which is the member states of the European Union, and then there may be an e-evidence proposal. But it all has to do with, you know, I, as a citizen of a member state of the European Union, and as an EU citizen, I have certain rights, which I do not have as a non-US citizen. And I keep using the same example to make it more, you know, to visualize it. If this were about Russia or China doing the same, you know, even if they're all the same safeguards in their laws, I still don't have the same standing. I don't have the same rights. And there's another... second point, that is that, okay, let's say that a warrant is issued here in the US obliging a company that has stored data in the European Union to hand over those data to the US authorities. The data stored in the European Union are covered by the EU GDPR and probably other laws as well. So then a company has to decide, am I going to comply with the US warrant, or am I going to comply with the EU GDPR? Tough one. And in some cases, I mean, they may contest, that's also foreseen, they may contest the warrant, but citizens' rights cannot depend on the choice of a company, you know, whether to comply with a court order or with the GDPR. I mean, that means that I am completely at the mercy, if you want. This is completely arbitrary. So I think that is really something that needs to be redressed. And then thirdly, within the European Union, if we get something like e-evidence, and we have similar instruments like, or let's say related instruments like the European arrest warrant, like the evidence warrant, like the investigation order, stuff like that. But that is all based on a system of cooperation, mutual recognition, common European standards, common European rights. Because I, as an EU citizen, I have the same rights no matter where I go in the European Union. And I know I can exercise those rights. So it puts me in a very different position if, let's say, the court order issued in, I don't know, Hungary, retrieving my data in the Netherlands, are then transferred. Puts me in a very different position. But there is, of course, there are some question marks there too, because we have a situation at the moment whereby there are some so-called judicial reforms in Poland, which we believe have led to a situation whereby the judiciary can no longer be considered independent. Now, this is not my political view. This has been established by all sorts of independent bodies. Okay, and there's even an official procedure that has been launched by the European Commission against Poland. So that, I mean, that makes it complicated, because let's say that it is a Polish court or a Polish authority issuing such a warrant, then, you know, what's the situation then? Should we recognize that or not? Is it then for the company concerned to say, no, you know, we're not going to comply with the warrant because it's been issued by the Polish authorities? I mean, you know, so there are some questions that we need to answer inside the European Union as well.
Yeah, but, you know, under today's law, if the U.S. government is investigating you and gets... or today's before the Cloud Act, gets a warrant and goes to the Dutch government under mutual legal assistance treaty. Is there any process in the Netherlands to decide whether that's a valid warrant under European law? Don't they simply accept, okay, we have a valid order issued by a judge in the United States? We have an obligation under the MLAT to effectuate the production of the evidence. We'll do that. And what opportunity would you have to, A, find out that you're under investigation and object
to the
production of that evidence?
Yeah, but the point is that the Dutch judge in this case would still be part of the democratic system in the state that I'm a citizen of, and where I can exercise
Dutch judge?
What do you mean, what Dutch
is,
judge?
Is there a right under an MLAT to have a review by a Dutch judge? Or is the process carried out by the government?
I can exercise my rights. I can challenge decisions in the Dutch system, which is a lot more difficult, not to say impossible. I cannot, as a Dutch citizen, yes, I have opportunities. Yes, you can litigate in the United States, but it's still, you know, it's a lot less certain. It's a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. People need to be covered by their own laws and not laws of a third country. Are the MLATs, do they need to be improved? Yes, I think everybody agrees on that, not least because the whole procedure is very cumbersome, and this is one of the reasons that authorities are trying to find a way around it, simply because it takes too long. Now, I think we should focus, first of all, on improving the MLATs, and then there's still gaps somewhere, then we need to find other solutions. But those solutions are supposed to be adopted in a proper, open, democratic procedure. And if it concerns, for example, my rights as an EU citizen, then I want to have a say over it. And I think that's only fair. And if we are friends and allies, then I think we should be able to find processes to ensure the protection of rights of each other's citizens. And mm-hmm. Progress has been made in this area. There's the Judicial Redress Act, but that is not 100% watertight. But it's definitely a step forward. But there have to be rights, because under the Judicial Redress Act, certain rights can be repealed unilaterally by the U.S., which means that they're not actually a right. Then it's something which is granted to me, a kind of favor. So I think, you know, if we allow authorities in the U.S. and in the EU, in this case, to exercise power over we over your citizens, you over our citizens, then the rights should also be guaranteed equally on both sides of the Atlantic. And that is simply not the case yet. And we have, of course, a system which has a slightly different philosophy, whereby everybody in the European Union is covered by the same laws. We don't have rights on the basis of nationality. If you're covered, for example, by European laws or the European Charter of Fundamental Rights, it applies to everybody. So it's a different approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move the conversation out to the audience. So invite your questions. I think we have a microphone at the back of the room, so please wait for the microphone to get to you. And you know, when you ask your question, if you can stand, just so everybody can see you and be sure to hear you. And if you could identify yourself, sir, on the aisle here.
So thank you. Thank you, Ms. Veld. My name is Carl Schoenander. I'm with the Software and Information Industry Association. And thanks for acknowledging the Judicial Redress Act. That's something that a number of us worked a lot on a couple of years ago. Two questions. On Privacy Shield, you talked a lot about implementation, and I think we're familiar with the issues there. You also mentioned something about that the legal basis was not sufficient. I'm not really sure I understood what you meant by that, so I wondered if you could elaborate on that. And then my second question is, after this discussion on the Cloud Act, so I take it you would not support either individual member state law enforcement sharing agreements with the United States per the Cloud Act, or, as the European Commission wants, an EU-US law enforcement sharing agreement per the Cloud Act. Thanks.
Well, on the first question, it's not so much that there's no legal base. The question is Privacy Shield compliant with the criteria set by the European Court of Justice in its ruling on safe harbor? Because it sets certain norms, if you want, and I believe, and some people who have challenged Privacy Shield in court also believe that it's not fully compliant. To give you a small example, the courts are actually, in, across a number of rulings, by the way, they're opposed to, let's say, the blanket, indiscriminate collection of personal data and long-term storage, let's say the bulk collection of data, and they say it has to be targeted. Now, in the this is, in, amongst other things, in the section 702, and there, indeed, there is talk of targeted surveillance, but the definition of targeted is a different one than we are using. And it's still, it could be, for example, targeted, that could cover a particular period of time or a particular area, which in our view is still bulk collection of data. So that's one of the things. Another question is whether indeed the Presidential Policy Directive can be seen as, you know, an adequate legal protection, or if that's too flimsy. I mean, there's that kind of question. So it's not so much about legal base, but about whether it complies with the court ruling on safe harbor. On the U.S. Cloud Act, would I consent to bilateral agreements between the member states and the U.S.? Well, first of all, it's not for me, you know, because I'm a member of the European Parliament, so I don't get to vote on national laws. But as a rule, you know, in any policy area, I don't like that instrument of 28 bilateral deals with the United States. I don't think it's in anybody's interest. It's not workable. I don't like it. Will I agree to a European agreement? Well, that remains very much to be seen. That all depends very much on the terms and conditions. In any case, I would never consent to something which has been which has been negotiated or which has not been adopted in, let's say, an open and democratic parliamentary procedure. I think that's really the very first condition for consenting to anything.
Additional questions? Ma'am.
Thank you, Liesl Brunner. Thanks for coming and speaking to us. It's a really interesting discussion. Following up on your point about equivalences on both sides of the Atlantic, what is the equivalent of PPD 28 on the European side? And I noticed it was very interesting that as the EU is negotiating with Japan to form an adequacy agreement, Japan, despite its incredibly strict data protection law, had to meet some extra steps, had to take some extra measures in order to qualify. And one of those was that EU citizens had to have a remedy against the Japanese government. Do Japanese citizens also have an effective remedy? Do U.S. persons have an effective remedy in Europe? And what does that look like?
Well, there are two questions, essentially. Do we have something like a presidential policy directive? Certainly not at the European level, because we have a completely different constitutional arrangement, if you want. Does it exist in countries like, I don't know, France, maybe? I don't know. But we have 28 different member states with different legal and constitutional traditions. So that I cannot say, but certainly not at European level. Any legal act or law would have to pass the proper parliamentary procedure. It would have to be negotiated with the other legislative branch, which is the Council, which is the 28 member states. And then on do Japanese and U.S. persons, for example, do they have the same rights to legal remedy in Europe? Yes. Because, again, they're all covered by... We don't have European rights and laws apply to everybody in Europe. For example, there are lots of people living in Europe, not just citizens from other countries like the US and Japan, but even stateless people who are living in the former communist states and who lost their nationality, in the whole process when they fell out of the Soviet Union. And so they don't have any nationality at all, but they're still covered by EU rights.
But so I, as a U.S. person trying to challenge the European government's access to my data in the way that a European person could perhaps have
a person. You can, under, for example, the GDPR or other pieces of data protection law, you can go to court. Sure.
So I guess to elaborate the question, though, it seems to me that for many years the norm in government surveillance internationally has been we may have certain protections for our own citizens, more or less, depending on the country. But outside our country, anything goes.
No.
And certainly as a traveling official, my security briefings always said, assume in any country you go, and this includes European countries, that you are under surveillance. And, in any place you go, anything you say, may, and your communications may be picked up. Mm-hmm. PPD 28 does set a new international norm. Say we are going to extend equivalent protections to the non-U.S. persons who have been subject to that anything goes rule. And I think the question goes to what extent has that norm been followed by European states or other countries?
I'm not sure that we followed PPD 28, but as I said, our whole system is based on a different assumption. It's not based on nationality. But I think in the end, because we're... you rightfully say that intelligence, security, law enforcement forces, they work across borders. They're sharing information, in particular the intelligence community. They're sharing information the whole time. And they're actually sometimes even trying to circumvent what you say, that they cannot spy on their own citizens by asking, you know, the intelligence services in the neighboring country to spy on our citizens and the other way around, and then they swap, kind of. And I think that means that rights of citizens, and also not, you know, if you're not just looking at the authorities and surveillance, but also what companies do with our data, I think it is high time that we should have some sort of global standards. And I heard that after the whole Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, which was a very clear example of why privacy protection is not only a right of the individual, but why it's also essential for protecting our democracies, that you know, people in the US also said, you know, hang on, we also want something, we want our own GDPR like law. I understand the law has been passed in California, which is very close. I think it's all a matter of, if you create powers on one side, then you also have to create the protections on the other side. And if powers, whether it's powers of the authorities or powers of big companies, if they extend across borders, then so should the protections and the rights of citizens. And I'm pretty confident, because I'm an optimist, otherwise I wouldn't be in politics. So I always believe that we can make things better and make them and change them. And I think this will happen. It will evolve. Because when I first started to work on privacy issues, which is about 15 years ago, you know, people at best thought that I was a harmless fool, and at worst that I was either going to kill industry or security or both. But today, nobody is questioning the importance of privacy protection anymore. I mean, and you can see that even companies like, I don't know, Facebook or Google, even if they do everything they can to abuse our data, because, you know, that's part of their business and it's legitimate, that's what businesses do, but they're increasingly talking about privacy and protecting our data because they realize it's important to people. They realize it's important to their customers. Just as 10 years ago, 20 years ago, if somebody wanted to sell a car, a manufacturer, he would say, "This is a great car. It can speed, and it's big, and it gives you status, and it's whatever, great car." But that has evolved. If you want to sell a car now, you have to say, it is environment friendly, it has low consumption, low emissions. That has to be part of the sales strategy. And the same is happening, I think, with privacy. 10 years ago, everybody said, yeah, you and privacy. Now everybody realizes it's important. And the fact that companies like Facebook and Google are trying to convince their customers that they care about the privacy of their customers means that they realize this is necessary to keep their customers on board, and it may well be. And I also think that when it comes to privacy, we have privacy laws, and that's a very important tool for ensuring our privacy, but there are other tools. One is competition laws, which is a very, very important tool, I think, for making, you know, forcing companies to take our privacy more seriously. If there is now a company which is really privacy friendly, it really has a competitive advantage. And company or competition law can, of course, also be used against monopolies that are using our data. And the second element is we need to monetize the value of personal data, not just to provide incentives and disincentives to, for example, companies, but also if you, for example, the whole the PNR thing and SWIFT and storing of data and more companies are actually being obliged by the law to store and process and provide personal data to law enforcement and security authorities, okay? There is a cost to that. It doesn't come for free. And the cost very often is borne by the companies, which in a way is not fair because they are carrying out a public task. Now, if the same cost had to be borne by those authorities who want those data, it would appear in the national budget. And then every year, politicians would have to explain why they want to spend money on on surveillance and on the collection of personal data and not on, I don't know, education, healthcare, new roads, whatever. And then it becomes political and more democratic. So I think expressing or sort of putting a price tag to personal data and a price tag to the use of personal data, whether it's by companies or by authorities, is also going to change privacy protection, I think.
Good. Well, maybe we'll get to a baseline federal law in the United States. I'll put in a plug for the paper that I put out as Brookings paper on privacy last week. So we've got time for anything about one more question over here on the right, my right.
Hi, my name is Wendy. I'm a sociologist at the University of Wisconsin. You mentioned earlier that there are many ways that we can address the privacy issue through domestic laws, competition laws, and we've also been talking a lot about surveillance. But increasingly, this issue has been taken up in trade agreements. And so I'm wondering, what do you see as the path forward in dealing with data flows and the free flow of cross-border data flows in trade agreements, and how has the EU conceptualized this with, recent trade agreements in Canada, Japan, and maybe going forward, the U.S.?
Okay, I'm not an expert on trade agreements, but in principle, there's been a kind of carve-out for that, which is, well, in a way that's a bit forced or artificial, because clearly it's a very important part of trade, and probably again I'm not an expert on trade agreements, but I'm sure that it will become part of future agreements. But then first there needs to be a proper basis. Then we need to know that our trading partners are going to respect the same rules. And again, I also think that. Look, the GDPR didn't come from nothing. We had, for 23 years, we had a data protection directive, which contained a lot of provisions that are also contained in the GDPR. And that's not, prevented trade from happening. And it's also forced somehow companies to adjust their strategies. And I think the GDPR will also become some sort of global standard, and industry will have an interest, like with the directive, which is also a standard which is being increasingly applied in other countries. They will have an interest, a commercial interest, in a global standard. And as the directive bit by bit became a global standard, or at least something that was a model, I think the GDPR will also become a global standard. And it's actually going to make it's going to protect our privacy, but I also believe it's going to make our industry more competitive and more innovative as well.
Let's try to squeeze in one more question, I think over here on the left. Yes, sir, right in front. Make the question short.
Short answer. Very short question. I'm Pablo Urbiola from the Institute of International Finance and an EU citizen. You were mentioning that in the European Union, privacy and data protection are considered fundamental rights. So should the EU promote a global debate on data protection to have international standards as we have for other fundamental rights? Because otherwise, we might end up in a situation with very different regulations across the world and problems for the digital economy, for the use of cloud computing, for international trade based in database services. So why not go back to a discussion on the principles?
No, I fully agree, and that's not being done sufficiently. We're promoting all sorts of human rights or fundamental rights or citizens' rights, but this one we don't promote it very, very strongly. And sometimes that leads to very cynical situations. One of the things that I find very difficult to stomach, for example, is that as part of the new immigration strategy, we're giving money to all sorts of governments, not necessarily, shining beacons of democracy and rule of law and fundamental rights, and we're paying them money to set up systems to register their citizens, border controls, storing biometrics, and some of those countries are actually dictatorships. So, you know, I find that very difficult to accept for a number of reasons, but this is one. Why don't we apply the same standards? If we believe that this is really a fundamental right, then that is a right that should apply to every single person on this earth and not just to us. So I agree.
Well, we need to wrap it up. Quickly, next year is an election year in the European Union. Any prognostications before we go?
No. You know, a week is a long time in politics, and 10 months is certainly a long time, but... it is a very exciting time. A lot is happening. And we have a saying in Dutch that under pressure, everything becomes fluid. And that is sometimes scary, but it's also the moment where you can actually give things a different shape. So it's very, very exciting.
Well, Sophie Hinfeldt, thank you very much. You've been outspoken, as promised.
Thank you for having me.